You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of February 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
Amidst all of this relief, I still feel a sense of concern, a real sense of worry, because if it's appropriate for me, if it's right for me to be free, then it's right for all of them to be free.
The Australian Al Jazeera journalist Peter Gresty is free and deported from Egypt. But he says he won't give up the fight until he gets his two colleagues out of jail too. Mary Dzhevsky and Sebastian Borger will discuss this and the other day's main stories. We also check in with our correspondent Jason Strother, who's currently in Manila.
The country is completely gripped by the death of 44 special operations officers who were killed at the end of last month in what appears to be a botch raid.
All that, plus the latest exhibitions in Italy and a preview of this year's carnival season in Brazil. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So lots coming up here on the next hour of Midori House, but first, here's Jonathan Wheatley.
The Australian journalist Peter Gresty said today it was a great relief to be freed from prison in Egypt, but added that he felt incredible angst about leaving two colleagues behind in prison. The Al Jazeera journalist was released on Sunday after 400 days in a Cairo jail. He's now in Cyprus on his way home to Australia. Gresty's colleagues, the Canadian-Egyptian Mohamed Fahmy and the Egyptian national Baher Mohamed, remain in prison. Hasiba Haj Serawi from human rights campaigners Amnesty International says much more needs to be done.
While we're rejoicing for Peter and his family, we're also asking members of the international community and all those who have supported Peter to focus all their efforts on the release not only of Mohamed Fahmy and Baha Mohamed, but also on the thousands of Egyptians who are currently in jail. Many of them simply for doing exactly the same as Peter, which is to exercise their right to freedom of expression.
Her comments come as an Egyptian court sentenced 183 supporters of the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood to death on Monday on charges of killing police officers, part of a sustained crackdown by authorities on Islamists. The men were convicted of playing a role in the killings of 16 policemen in the town of Kardasa in August 2013 during the upheaval that followed the army's ouster of the Islamist President Mohamed Morsi. Yanis Varoufakis, the Greece's new finance minister, has ruled out accepting more bailout cash. On a visit today in London, he agreed with the British finance minister George Osborne that it was necessary to end the so-called pretense that had led Greece being a burden on the rest of Europe.
My concern, as a European first, is that this present bailout programme is costing the rest of Europe, not just us, too much. We're interested in minimising the losses to our partners. And the best way of doing that is by assisting Greece to turn a page, to reform, and to start growing so we can actually afford to pay back everything with interest.
Brussels police have detained a Slovakian man dressed in camouflage gear near the European Parliament and found a gun and a chainsaw in his car, triggering a security scare which caused several buildings to be evacuated. The man told police officers that he wanted to meet the European president. A judge will determine on Tuesday whether he faces charges. And Dominic Strauss-Kahn, the former International Monetary Fund chief, tipped to become French president before a New York hotel maid accused him of a sexual assault in 2011. Has gone on trial today in France in a separate case of alleged procuring of prostitutes. He risks as much as 10 years in jail and a fine of up to €1.5 million if convicted. Well, international lawyer Christophe Mesnou said the latest scandal dates back to before the affair in New York.
There were anonymous tips that were made to the police in Lille in very early 2011. Claiming that there was a prostitution ring operating in that city, and the police started to investigate, and after a number of weeks they discovered that a number of people were involved, including apparently Mr. Strauss-Kahn.
And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24. And you're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18.05, 13.05 in New York. And joining me now with a take on the news here in the studio is Mary Jedeski and the London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung, Sebastian Burger. Welcome both to the programme. Well, the Al Jazeera journalist Peter Gresty, an Australian, is probably still getting used to what it feels like to be free after having spent 400 days in a jail in Cairo. He says he's relieved, but is feeling incredible angst after having left his two colleagues behind. Gresty was arrested with his two colleagues in 2013 on charges of spreading false news and aiding the Muslim Brotherhood. Two other Al Jazeera journalists, Baha Mohammed and Mohammed Fahmy, are still imprisoned in Egypt. And Gresty swears that he will not give up the fight to get them out too. Mary, just starting with you, it's of course great that he's been released from jail today. But as we say, these two other journalists remain in jail. And we were just hearing the headlines there, you know, 130-odd people being condemned to death for supposedly trying to overthrow the government and be supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. In a way, Peter Gresty has had so much coverage. I think, do you think there's a bit of, you know, I've just been looking online and people saying that people are not quite sure how to respond to the news. They don't want to get too elated about it. It feels a bit uncomfortable, even being excited about him getting out in some ways.
I found a lot of this whole saga extremely uncomfortable, actually. When he was condemned and the time he was in prison, I actually felt that sort of international journalistic solidarity, which is usually very, very firm and makes a lot of publicity in these cases, that it was surprisingly low-key. And now that he's been released and deported to Australia, I find almost the reverse, that the coverage, at least on British media yesterday evening when he was released, was almost saturation coverage, as though there was absolutely nothing else happening in the world. And yes, people pointed out that it was a contradictory situation because his two colleagues were still in prison, though it was hoped that the one who's a Canadian dual national, that he would be released and deported similarly. So it wasn't a clear picture. But I did feel that there was a sort of journalistic preference here in the way his release had been covered, which didn't sit very well with the low-key coverage of his imprisonment.
Sebastian, the other strange thing is, I think it came just after, you know, the beheading of a Japanese journalist by Islamic State forces. And again, when you see the kind of the horrors that are facing journalists within the region. In fact, what Peter Gresty was facing wasn't nice and wasn't good and wasn't fair. But again, it seemed wrong that it was in the same pecking order, in a way, on the front pages.
To be honest, I find it a little bit churlish. Let's just, for once, celebrate good news. You know, he's out. Let's be happy about that. Now, and then, obviously, move on to the next stage, which is getting the other two guys out. First of all, I think that the main thing is admiration for all of these colleagues to actually go into these very difficult arenas. And as Mary quite rightly points out, we need to keep up the pressure for the ones who are still in jail, not just in Egypt, I may add. I mean, there's a number of other people in jail around the world.
But what do you feel? You know, that obviously there was. Do you think there was some naivety, not with Gresty, but with Al Jazeera? Al Jazeera knew that they were, you know, seen as representatives, even if, you know, they were not representatives of the Qatari government and the administration there, and the Qataris were seen as backing the Muslim Brotherhood. They were there without, you know, the correct accreditation, which they admit. Do you think that they were unwise to send? You know, do you think there was some blame on both sides in a way?
I wouldn't call it blame, but I certainly think yes. I mean, what Mary sort of detected in the coverage of their ordeal has possibly something to do with Al Jazeera, with the slightly shady reputation that Al Jazeera has in some parts of the world, at least. So that's definitely part of the story. But you know, he was. They all three are well respected enough to be acknowledged to be proper journalists doing a very important job.
Now, Mary, what's going to happen now? It seems almost inevitable. He's been released. The West will find it easier to engage with, you know, the Egyptian government and the Egyptian president, and these two gentlemen who happen to have Muslim names. You just fear that it's going to go rather quiet on the kind of the campaigning front.
Yes, you do. And I mean, I thought some of the things that Peter Gresty's relatives were saying last night as he was arriving in Cyprus, they were saying that they acknowledged that he had been treated differently. And they also suggested that, well, that they said that the campaign had to go on. And obviously, I think when Peter Gresty has recovered, he will be out there doing his absolute best because, you know, if nothing else, you do have to feel, you know, if you're in his position, that it's in some ways almost worse to be alone and free than to be sharing the fate of the other two. I think, you know, as was also being said yesterday, that the dual national Canadian, because he's got a national government to fight for him, he will be in a better position than the third person. But yes, I mean, I think the campaign has to go on.
Well, yeah, you do sense that, you know, if you have an Egyptian passport, there's going to be nobody really who's going to be an effective voice to campaign for you, Sebastian. Don't you think that, you know, that there are so many terrible things still unfolding in Egypt? But what do you make of the kind of West's kind of, you know, while all this has been going on, there hasn't been much kind of stepping away from the Egyptian government, perhaps because of what we're seeing happening in Sinai with the Islamic State there, a sense that, you know, that we need a few kind of bulwarks against Islamic State, that, you know, we can't be seen to kind of step away from the regime in Cairo. Do you feel that, you know, actually it wasn't really that much of a thorn inside, that the West had to stay engaged with Egypt, whatever happened?
That's a fact of life. The West got its fingers very badly burned by the so-called Muslim, what was it called? Spring. And you know, Egypt is a case in point. I'm not entirely sure whether I agree that there aren't effective organizations around the world fighting for journalists of all nationalities. I mean, Index on Censorship does that. Amnesty International does that. I'm sure there are other organizations which now escape me. But the West, of course, needs to stay engaged with Egypt. That's realpolitik.
Well, that's the news that the Australian Al Jazeera journalist Peter Gresty has been freed today in Cairo. But we'll move on now to events in eastern Ukraine. The pro-Russian rebel leader Alexander Zakharchenko was today quoted by Russian news agencies as saying that he wanted to boost the number of his forces to 100,000. Elsewhere in the news, the New York Times revealed on Sunday that the Obama administration is considering giving arms to Ukrainian forces. The US is more open to the idea after the rebel offensive that shattered a five-month truce. Mary, you know the region well, and you know the politics very well. It's very easy to say you want another 100,000 people. That doesn't mean that you're going to get another 100,000, but it does certainly seem as though a huge amount of activity on that front again, and that the rebels are making advances.
Well, that's what it looks like. I mean, I'm not entirely convinced that that's so, because they haven't, it doesn't seem to me, been able to fight and hold that much additional territory since the initial ceasefire, which sort of held and sort of didn't hold, was agreed back in September. So I'm not sure that they're actually doing quite as well as it looks. I mean, this figure of, you know, 100,000, a force of 100,000, I mean, that seems to me to be completely unrealistic. I'm not even sure. it's a very small area. When you look at a map of Ukraine, the land that is being fought over now is really a very small percentage. I'm not even sure that there would be, you know, even in the best of all worlds for the rebels, that they would be able to muster anything like that number. I think the you also talked about the stance of the United States and possibility of supplying weapons or something, sort of sub-weapons, to the Kiev side. I think this would be absolutely catastrophic. I mean, I'm sure that Obama is under some pressure to do that from the Republican Congress and from certain sections, which have always been very militant in support of sort of pro-Western governments and groups in East and Central Europe. And they will see supplying Kiev with military hardware as being the pursuit of that same ideological fight for freedom across Europe. I think it would be an absolute catastrophe because it's an open invitation for Russia to say that its own security is directly threatened and there's outside military intervention in Ukraine. I can't think of anything worse.
Sebastian, can't think of anything worse, but what else is there? We've tried talks, there have been various get-togethers in Minsk, we've tried sanctions. They can't seem to be working if this is still going on. What is there left to do?
In the end, you either decide that you want to stick with the strategy that seems to be Angela Merkel's position, who has clearly ruled out any military assistance, or you take up the challenge that, of course, Russia poses. I mean, Russia is fighting a war. We're talking about the rebels. Well, let's not beat about the bush. Who is behind them? Who is supplying them? Who has actually sent regular soldiers there? And maybe part of that 100,000 additional troops are again people who pose in rebel uniforms, but are actually part of the regular Russian army. Sooner or later, there comes a point where you have to decide: well, are you giving up, or are you taking up the challenge?
Mary, when you kind of look at, you know, this is a country that not so long ago we were talking about joining NATO, potentially being a member of the EU, all sorts of things. That certainly seems to be off the table for now. So in a way, has Russia got what it wanted? Because those were the things that concerned it. It felt, you know, it had some perhaps legitimate anxiety about being surrounded by, you know, NATO members. It's kind of got what it wants, really, hasn't it?
Well, you see, I would almost put it the other way around, that I think the problem is that Russia hasn't got what it wants, because it wasn't actually European Union, even long-term prospective membership for Ukraine that was the problem. NATO certainly was a problem, but my feeling is that it was actually to do with Russia's own sense of its security. And so long as there is fighting, so long as there is essentially no properly demarcated and defendable border in eastern Ukraine, Russia will not feel that its security is intact. And so long as the European Union and the Americans are all talking sanctions without any sort of any serious indication, at least in public, of what Russia needs to do to have the sanctions scaled back, except maybe get out of Crimea, which is the one thing that isn't going to happen, then I don't think Russia's got what it wants at all.
Sebastian, just before we move on, what's intriguing is, you know, that they went in, they took Crimea, they snatched it off of Ukraine. No one talks about that anymore. That seems to be absolutely forgotten. There's no kind of hope of that ever being reunited with Ukraine. So again, in that sense of, you know, what the Russians want, you know, perhaps they're happy to have a kind of continuous bit of war going on. It's a distraction.
I would certainly suggest that. And I mean, Mary is kindly pointing out the Russian perspective, and that's very understanding. But I mean, we did have a border, you know. There was a border, and there was not a threat of a perceivable threat to Russia's security from that border, until Mr. Putin decided to enlarge his territory, for the first time since the end of the Second World War. So, yeah, I can't see what you can do satisfy the demands of a security demands which seem to me slightly verging on the paranoid.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Pandora House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Mary Jajewski, who's, of course, chief editorial writer and columnist for The Independent, and also Sebastian Borger. Now, when we return, we're going to take a look at how likely the new Greek foreign finance minister is likely to find allies from Berlin on his Europe tour.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me is Mary Jajewski, chief editorial writer at The Independent, and Sebastian Borger of the Berliner Zeitung. Now, the Greek finance minister, Yanis Varoufakis, is busy looking for new European friends. He's currently in London after visiting Paris yesterday. At least there, he was met with some sympathy. The French finance minister said that Greece needs a new contract with Europe. The next capital on his tour is Rome, and after that, well, will he go to Berlin? Sebastian, what do you think?
Well, of course, the Germans have been rather irritated that they've been left out so far. And he has now gracefully suggested that he might eventually go there. Well, good luck to him. I'd much rather be a mouse at tonight's investor meeting that he's holding in the City of London to see whether he finds any allies there. That'll be very interesting.
But what did you make of the fact that the French were actually a bit sympathetic towards his cause? Do you feel that there is within Europe a kind of growing feeling that actually, you know, we need to do a deal with this man?
Well, look, of course we need to do a deal with this man. There's a lot of rhetoric, and I have to say, when I heard the news on Sunday, and then on Monday, the very strange coalition that they went into with these nationalistic right-wingers, a bit odd, then a lot of unhelpful rhetoric, which they have already pared down now after the Greek bank shares fell by 40%, and I think they've got an outflow of something like 5 billion every day out of the country. They clearly realize that there is a deal to be struck, and there is a deal. I'm sure there is a deal. Even the French, who you say are sympathetic to the Greeks, have said they need to do structural reforms. There is no way around it. They've got to fight with the corruption. They would get plenty of support, even from Germany, if they actually tackled the oligarchs, particularly in the shipping industry, which have held Greece at random, aided and abetted by the City of London, I may add.
Mary, it's quite fascinating. And you don't know whether it's all negotiations, but he does say some, you know, some almost contradictory things. You know, he says, you know, we're not going to kind of default on the debt. We don't want to borrow any money. We need, you know, he said today that he felt that they were like, you know, a drug addict that need to do cold turkey. So in some ways, he says the right things, and he says he wants to smash the oligarchies in Greece again. You know, perhaps pleasing some other European cities. But on the other hand, he's not going to play easy with Germany either. What do you make of his kind of his tactics so far?
Well, I think on the one hand, we've seen quite a, as you pointed out, we've seen a lot of conflicting messages. Things like saying we don't envisage leaving the euro. We intend to pay up, but sort of like not yet. Yes, we want to do reforms, but you look at this at the shape of this particular government, and you ask, well, you know, how actually equipped and capable would they be of pushing through reforms? You can look at all that, and you're really not sure where you stand. The itinerary for the finance ministers' trips around Europe does look like the sort of anti-austerity or anti-euro tour, going to France, then on to Italy via London. And I look at London and think, well, I'm not quite sure what message he's going to get from the city and from the government here. Because the British government, ever since the euro crisis, has been in a very strange situation of saying, on the one hand, it's absolutely terrific that Britain isn't in the euro. This has really saved us a whole lot of trouble. And the economy is much stronger and we took the right decision. On the other hand, both the Prime Minister, David Cameron, and the Chancellor, George Osborne, have been practically commuting to Brussels, trying, insofar as they can from outside, to shore up the euro and to say the last thing that is in Britain's interest is for the euro to collapse, because the City of London and the British economy is so tied in with Europe. So I'm not sure that if the finance minister from Greece was expecting to get friendly noises from and lots of fraternal support from London, I'm not sure that he's going to get it here.
I urge the Greek finance minister to act responsibly, is what George Osborne said. I mean, you couldn't have been any clearer.
Yeah. But, you know, you have your finger on the pulse of what German public opinion is. You know, first of all, he did this very contentious thing when he, you know, when the government was sworn in. You know, the prime minister, one of his first actions was to go to this memorial to people who had, you know, fought against the Nazis during the Second World War. There seemed to be kind of, you know, there was certainly lots of meaning in that action. And now, as you say, he's kind of dodged around Germany. He hasn't gone there first, where you normally would have been the first port of call. This is who has kind of put in the money to kind of help, you know, the Greeks get out of their problems. What do you think, if he does go to Germany, both public mood and government mood, do you think there's any kind of wriggle room there?
Well, first of all, to be honest, I think that the German public could do with a little remembering of what German occupation did to Greece in the Second World War, because this is one of the sort of, I wouldn't call it a blind spot, but certainly not very well researched, and it's been pretty awful. Pretty awful. And you always have to remember, of course, that he does that in his domestic context. The Greeks remember their civil war after the Second World War very well, whereas nobody else does. And this country is still much more divided, I think, between hard left and hard right than we normally sort of acknowledge. So that's a gesture which I think the German public can swallow. That's not a problem. But what I think worries people since then are these rather contradictory messages. And when you look at the election result and the opinion polls in Greece, where even after 5 years of austerity, three quarters of people say we want to stay in the euro, they've understood that getting out would be a hell of a lot worse than it is now, then he can be tough in negotiations, but he'll have to say that occasionally. You know, we want to be part of the club. We don't want to fool around with Putin. We don't want to actually get out of the euro. We want a new deal. I think there are quite a few takers for a new deal, even in Germany.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Fascinating stuff. That was, of course, Mary Dzhejewski of the Independent newspaper here in London and Sebastian Burger of the Berliner Zeitung. Thank you both very much for joining us. Well, plenty still to come on the second half of Midori House. I'm going to tell you all about that in a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, in the next half hour, we're going to check in on the new art exhibitions in Italy, get a preview of this year's carnival in Brazil, as the build-up has already begun. But before we get started on any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Thanks very much. The Australian journalist Peter Gresta said today it was a great relief to be freed from prison in Egypt, but added that he felt incredible angst about leaving two colleagues behind in prison. The Al Jazeera journalist is now in Cyprus on his way home to Australia. Greece's new finance minister has ruled out accepting more bailout cash. Yanis Varoufakis, on a visit today in London, agreed with the British finance minister George Osborne that it was necessary to end the so-called pretense that had led Greece becoming a burden on the rest of Europe. Brussels police have detained a Slovakian man dressed in camouflage gear near the European Parliament and found a gun and chainsaw in his car, triggering a security scare which caused several buildings to be evacuated. And Dominic Strauss-Kahn, the former International Monetary Fund chief, has gone on trial today in Paris, in Lille, in France, today in a special case of alleged procuring of prostitutes. He risks as much as 10 years in jail and a fine of up to €1.5 million if he is found guilty. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan, and welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. The time in Moscow is 21:32. It's 18:32 here in London and 16:32 in Sao Paulo. And we continue now with our regular whip round of stories making the front pages in one part of the world. Today, we head to the Philippines. A bit earlier, Marcus Hippie spoke to Monocle's correspondent, Jason Strother, who's currently in Manila.
Well, the country is completely gripped by the death of 44 special operations officers who were killed at the end of last month in what appears to be a botch raid on individuals that the Philippines government as well as the U.S. government says were high-level terrorists. These special forces were operating down on the southern island of Mindanao, where the Philippines for decades have fought insurgents, namely the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, the MILF, as its unfortunate acronym. These forces evidently went into this area that was controlled by the MILF. They did not coordinate with members of the MILF who have been in discussions. Let me back up for a second, Marcus. For the past few years, the Philippines government and the MILF have been engaged in peace talks. They have been this close to finally resolving these territorial issues, and a deal is underway to give this region of this on the island of Mindanao some autonomy. The Philippines forces went into this area, did not coordinate with the MILF officials. They thought they were being under siege by the Filipino special forces, and a 12-hour firefight broke out. 44 special forces dead. One of the two militants that the forces were after has been reportedly killed. The other is on the loose. But now the entire peace process has been thrown into question as President Aquino says he wants criminal charges filed against the MILF fighters who killed these 44 officers. There's a call for a truth commission to be launched. So right now it looks like we're sliding back in the whole peace process here in the Philippines.
So what is the aftermath like now after this unfortunate raid? What are the papers writing, for example? What are the questions being asked?
Well, right. I mean, all the papers want to know what really happened. President Aquino says he did not give the order for these troops to go into the territory held by the MILF. The interior minister says he was unaware of this operation taking place. So the papers are asking, well, who was in charge? Who made this call? And there seems to be pressure mounting in the Congress here to launch a truth commission to get to the bottom of it. Meanwhile, some lawmakers here want revenge on who killed these 44 men.
Well, Jason, let's move on to your second story for today then. It's about the Philippines and Japan getting closer to each other as the result of increasing tensions in the South China Sea and East China Sea as well.
The Philippines and Japan, old Second World War foes, have now found a common threat, and that is China. Of course, Japan and China have been locked in a territorial dispute in waters in the East China Sea, and the Philippines and China have increasingly been at odds over territorial waters in the Southeast China Sea, namely the Spratly Islands. So now the Philippines Defense Secretary has visited Tokyo. Tokyo and Manila have signed pacts now for more naval cooperation, other intelligence sharing. They're working more close together as they see China as a common threat. Both sides say the tensions need to be resolved peacefully, but the Philippines it perhaps has the most to lose in this whole dispute in the South China Sea. It's called on its allies in ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, to really stand up against China, saying that the whole backbone of ASEAN depends on them being able to unify against China's expansion into the waters here.
So what do you think, what are going to be the most significant changes now that we see the Philippines and Japan basically collaborating more?
Well, I think the Philippines military is developing, let's say, and I think Japan, with its defense forces, can give some much needed training to the Philippines forces here. Japan has had much more experience dealing with putting off China, keeping the situation from not getting hot in the East China Sea, and perhaps some of that experience can lead to the Philippines diffusing tensions and being perhaps more on guard as appears that China seems to keep gobbling up reefs and shoals and other pieces of land in the South China Sea.
Finally, Jason, the tourism industry in Philippines has been growing during the last years, and now there's new hopes of, well, the country basically becoming a new destination for gambling.
Right. Well, today was the big day here in Manila. The City of Dreams Mega Casino officially opened. It's a compound that involves three different hotels. It's a massive dome surrounded by golden towers right on Manila Bay. Gambling officials here, the gaming officials hope that this is going to be the start where the Philippines sees its revenue from gaming, which is about $2 billion a year right now, move up to $10 billion a year. And that would put the Philippines ahead of Macau and even ahead of Las Vegas.
So Jason, finally, why do you think people would choose Philippines over, say, Las Vegas?
Well, one, they're trying to attract Chinese visitors. And already, some of the casinos that have been built here in Manila have been really reaching out to attract Chinese. And what some of the officials involved in this City of Dream project say, as there's been more crackdowns in China against corruption, they feel that the high rollers in China will want to take their money here to the Philippines as opposed to Macau. And of course, not as easy for some of those people to get over to the United States. So they see the Philippines as the perfect destination for those with a lot of loot to put it down on the table, Marcus.
Well, that was Jason Strada in Manila speaking to Monocle's Marcus Hippie. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll hear from our resident Brazilian what to expect from this year's carnival season.
Spirit, love, energy, and culture to be quickly accessible. Unreroute the river, let the damned water be. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst, and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism, at Monocle 24 we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. In Brazil, the build-up for the carnival has already begun, although the main celebrations are not until next week. People have already taken to the streets in events all over the country. It's been a tough summer in Brazil, where there have been quite a few power shortages and water shortages and corruption scandals. But Brazilians are not going to let this stop the party. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, a Brazilian who works for us here in Midori House, is in the studio with me, and also joining me on the line from Rio de Janeiro is our correspondent there, Sheena Rossiter. Sheena, let's jump to you first. We painted a picture there that it's been a bit of a tough summer, one of the hottest summers, I think, on record as well for Brazil. What is the mood in the different cities around the country? Are people feeling that, you know, this is a bit of a tougher year to celebrate Carnival? Is it going to be a bit quieter?
It definitely will be quieter in some municipalities, especially in the south of Minas Gerais. There's about 10 municipalities there that have already announced that they're actually canceling this year's carnival because of the water shortage, which is impacting almost 50 million people here in Brazil. That's about a quarter of the population. So it definitely is a bit more of a somber mood in certain places, in certain municipalities, especially places like Sao Paulo. Here in Rio, though, the party goes on, and it's still massive, and it's still unavoidable, and literally around every corner that you turn here. So Rio, definitely not canceled, but smaller municipalities are kind of steering clear of Carnival this year because of the difficulties like the power outages and the water shortage.
Fernando, many of these events, you know, while not good, they get picked up by the carnival in some way, don't they? They get reflected in what happens on the streets. How will these scandals be, you know, treated by the carnival goers?
Well, we can make fun of it. And actually, this year is a classic year for that. You know, we did that already with other politicians. But this time we're going to actually, you know, Brazil masks are an extremely popular thing that every Brazilian wear a mask of a personality. For example, we had Obama, Bin Laden and several other figures. But this year, you know what we're going to wear? The mask of Maria das Graças Foster. Maybe for foreigners, you don't know who she is. She's the president of Petrobras, which is currently undergoing a huge corruption trial, you know, and you know, she's the president. So
this is the big oil company for
exactly,
Brazil.
Exactly. And as you can see, I even printed a picture of her for you. I mean, she doesn't look anything extreme, you know. She's actually have a very interesting bio. But I have a funny story to tell you, actually. She was not the first choice. In fact, we had an executive from Petrobras. His name is Nestor Cervero. And I have to say, he has one eye that is lower than the other one. He was the one who was going to be the mask, but his lawyer threatened to sue all the people who were making the masks. And they were afraid. So they said, oh, let's swap to Maria das Graças Foster. And I think she's become even more popular than Nestor as a mask.
Well, it's quite good that she kind of went with it. At least there's not that sticking to her. Sheena, explain to us, you know, when you're an outsider and you haven't been to Brazil or you don't know Rio, you don't understand Carnival, you don't quite get how culturally important this is to the city. It's not just a party where people go at the weekends. Brazil kind of shuts down in its big cities for these weeks.
Oh, definitely. The ongoing joke, actually, with many Brazilians is that the New Year doesn't start until after Carnival, that there's a big lull between January and half of February, if you will. So, of course, all of Brazil is shut down, and especially here in Rio de Janeiro, the party's been going on since the start of January, and it really kicked off last weekend when there was some 400 blocos fed throughout the city on the weekend. And what these blocos are is basically they're the translation would be like a block party, and they're basically, they have a float, they have a theme, they have music, so people attend these blockos, which don't typically last much longer than an hour or so, and you dress up based on the theme, and you just basically follow the float as it goes from point A to point B on its assigned route, if you will, and then you just enjoy it for those next few hours, and then you pick up and go to the next one and maybe switch costumes along the way, because if you don't wear one of these costumes, you're kind of invisible at these blockos, and that's just part of the fun. It's like a month-long Halloween here in Rio de Janeiro, if you will.
Now, Fernanda, we associate this being very, very Brazilian, but many outsiders get to be part of the carnival world too. And there's a Swiss person who is going to be celebrated this year.
Well, exactly. And it's interesting, all the samba schools, they have to choose a theme, you know, for the year. And this year, Unidos da Tijuca, one of the most famous samba schools, they chose Clovis Bornay. Basically, he's the son of Swiss parents. But basically, the whole kind of, the whole theme of the samba school is going to be about Switzerland as well. Just to introduce, basically, Clovis Bornay was a very kind of, he was gay, he was very camp, and he's a very famous carnival costume maker for more than 40 years. He had a very famous name. He died in 2005. So basically, Unidos da Tijuca, they're bringing some Swiss people to dance in the arena as well. And of course, you know, we have those amazing samba cars, and they're going to have some snow banks and chocolate as well. So it's very interesting how different topics come. For example, another samba school, Beija-Flor, they're going to do a special parade on Equatorial Guinea, which actually joined the Lusophone community, which we covered the Monaco last year. So it's quite interesting, those choices.
Sheena, just quickly tell me, any highlights you're looking forward to this year? Will you be there in your costume?
Of course. That's, you know, that one of my favorite non-holiday holidays before I moved to Brazil is Halloween, so I gladly welcome the fact that I can dress up in multiple costumes on multiple days here in Brazil. It's so much fun, and I'm definitely looking forward to Bom na Cozinha, which is basically put it in a takeout box, and that's going to be a food bloco that's happening here this Saturday in Rio de Janeiro, the first food bloco that has ever happened here in Rio de Janeiro, and it basically is combining two things that I absolutely love, samba music and food.
Well, thank you very much, Sheena. It's Sheena Roster, who's our correspondent in Rio. And you had heard Fernando Augusto Pacheco too. And I'm going to share the duties of, because we're going to play some Brazilian music now. And you kind of want to hear it pronounced in a kind of rich Brazilian voice. So take it away. What are we going to listen
well,
to?
Well, let's dance, because it's a very up-tempo song from Adriano Sintra and Rogério Flauzino. And the song is called Desde o Início.
Dias de amor sem fim. Me passa o espelho, me conta o que você está vendo. Esse rosto eu nunca vi, e foi assim que eu me rendi. Quando a gente fazia, éramos recortistas. Volta aqui, vem pra mim, que eu quero mais. Vem curar meu vício. E foi desse jeito. Fim, ia ser tudo tão ruim. Quando a gente
gente fazia. Éramos recordistas. Volta aqui, vem pra mim, que eu quero mais. Vem curar meu vício. E foi desse jeito desde o início. Foram noites sem dormir, dias de calor sem fim. Quebrei o espelho, estilhaçou, não tem remendo. Esse rosto eu nunca vi, eu nunca mais me reconhecia. Quando a gente fazia, éramos recordistas. Volta aqui, vem pra mim, que eu quero mais. Vem curar meu vício. E foi desse jeito desde o início.
Well, that was Desde o Inicio by Adriano Sintra featuring Rogério Fazinho. And you're listening to Midori House here on Monaco 24, and it's time now for our daily culture review segment. And today we look at art in Italy. Luca Mastrantonio is the journalist at Corriere della Sera's Sunday Cultural Supplement and a regular here on Monaco 24, and he joins me on the line now. Now we're going to start with something that's not very Italian, an American indeed, well, a German via America, Wim Wenders, who's got an exhibition indeed entitled America.
Yeah, hi, Henry. Hi, everybody. It's a sort of melting pot culture exhibition. I like it. It's Wim Wenders America at Villa Panza in Varese, close to Milan in the north of Italy. And it's an original exhibition because it's a film, but it's a collection of photos the filmmaker made since the 70s until the first years of the new millennium. And the exhibition is dedicated to really a strange couple, intriguing couple, to the borderline actor, a friend of Wim Wenders, Dennis Hopper, and the artist, the almost famous Edward Hopper. So it's very strange couple, just like muses. And you have in these photos, place in the middle of nowhere, in the desert. You have a cowboy bar in the desert, or a ghost city called California City, with nothing, only maybe the past American dream. And on the other hand, you have a metropolitan place full of urban loneliness. You have empty shop in Las Vegas, or drive-in in Marfa. So if you like the particular melancholy of the German director, of course you will like it. It's a good exhibition.
And what's interesting, he became very good friends, of course, with Dennis Hopper, who was also, in fact, a very good photographer. And I think, like, although they weren't related, I believe, the painter Edward Hopper, they both picked up on this kind of this sense of loneliness and the big open road and that, as you say, that melancholy view of America.
Yeah, I think it's the poetic of Wim Wenders. If we think about Cuba or Portugal. But this time, maybe with the photography, we can see the immensity of the nature and the empty space of America. So it's typical European test. And of course, I was thinking about Dennis Hopper and the iconic film, but of course also about photography. It's really strange, the light in the photos. You have to see it. It's really intriguing.
Well, somebody from a little bit further back in history, there's also an exhibition on Leonardo, Studies on Water. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, I want to suggest that the place is Pinacoteca Ambrosiana in Milan. It's one of the first public libraries in the world, and it's particular because for all the year of the expo in Milan, every 3 months, yeah, they change the exhibition because is the Codex Atlanticus of Leonardo da Vinci, a sort of master book full of works, sketches, and studies of engineering. This time, until March, you can see Studies on Water, the project that he realized in Tuscany, where he was born, and also in close to Milan. Milan, before the fascism, was a city full of water, thanks to Leonardo da Vinci. So you can check when you came in Milan, Pinacoteca Ambrosiana, and you will find different folios of this, incredible codex of maybe the best Italian genius.
So this is for a project that he did, which was to create waterways in Lombardy and Tuscany, which included hydraulic machines and pumps and fountains. So it's literally his kind of drawings for the plans, is it?
Yeah, it's full of sketches and projects and, exactly about the canals and the pumps. The hydraulic pumps were really modern in his conception. Just something revolutionary and not for killing someone just like the war machine, also included in the Codex Atlanticus.
And then finally, an exhibition about somebody who I don't know anything about, Mario Dondero. Who's this?
Yeah, you have to know it, because Mario Dondero is maybe, we can say he's the best Italian photo reporter at all. He's a sort of biographer of a nation. He was born in, I think, in the 28th, of the last 29 of the last century. And he started like journalists, and he say, I have a lot of problem with the photos. Can I make my photos? And a lot of newspaper send him to the place because he's really nice. He's a chronicist, but he's affectionate minimalism. Also, if the subject is Pierpaolo Pasolini or a common farmer. And the place, it's really nice because this exhibition, the name is only Mario Dondero, is Le Grandi Terme di Diocleziano in Rome, the big ancient spa. So also the contrast is really, it's really huge, and I suggest it's full of 200 of photos. You have to see it. Yeah.
And just let me know, what kinds of images, if you were Italian and you knew him as a famous photographer, what kinds of images is it that he was famous for?
He's famous, of course, one of Pierpaolo Pasolini, full of Rome famous icons, extraordinary people. But also, it's not about, I have no titles, but I have the image, especially the skin of common people, just like just a farmer can be compared to the famous photos of Brecht. It seems that he's an intellectual, also an ordinary people. He used to immortalize also famous and non-famous person. He's a sort, and of course he was a photo reporter, so not known for title, but for events. He covered all the most important Italian events and also in Europe.
And I'm just looking, he had exhibitions, you know, all around Italy and indeed, you know, outside Italy as well. You know, he was one of those famous Italian characters, I guess.
Yeah, I was talking about Pasolini. Maybe it's one of the most famous portraits by Mario Dondero, yeah.
Well, brilliant. Well, thank you very much for joining us as ever. That was Luca Mastrantonio, who is a journalist at the Corriere della Sera newspaper on their Sunday cultural supplement. And he's a regular here on Monocle 24. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Mary Jajewski and Sebastian Borger. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by David Pleasant, Jonathan Bartlett and Stefano Fumagalli. And our studio manager was Antonio Fernandez. Next, after the headlines, it's The Culture Show with Robert Bound. Then at 2200 hours, it's The Monocle Daily, today with Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds. This show, well, it's going to be back at the same time tomorrow, which is, of course, 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's time for me to say goodbye and thank you very much for listening.